continuing our series looking at Matthew's Gospel, and tonight it's called How to Be Offended Well. So I'm going to offend you for half an hour and give you some practice. Not really. Here's the question: how do you tend to respond when someone offends you? How do you tend to respond when someone offends you? Theo's smiling. Not how you think you should respond, how you generally do respond when somebody offends you. Who tends to respond when they get offended in a way that they think is a good way? Ollie's a bit unsure, and that's about everybody else. Who thinks they tend to respond in the wrong way? Quite a few people. A few of you, I can see why you've answered that way. Not really. Anyway, how we answer this question has a big effect on our lives and on our relationships. We're all human. We all get offended by things at times, and we probably all offend other people at some point, whether we mean to or not. But if someone deeply offends us, how are we supposed to deal with it? If it's continuous, like it keeps happening, or it's really serious, how should a community deal with it, or even a whole society? If only there was a great model for dealing with it when we get offended, a plan of action for our relationships. Today, we're looking at this passage in Matthew 18, it's verses 15 to 20. This is what Jesus says about responding to offence. And guess what? It's absolute genius. If we all did what we're about to read, then it'd be better for us and be better for the world, okay? He doesn't just say, do this. He says, here is how to do this, and we need all the help we can get. So here we are. This is the Jesus guide to dealing with offence, okay? If your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault just between the two of you. If they listen to you, you have won them over. But if they will not listen, take one or two others along, so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If they still refuse to listen, tell it to the church. And if they refuse to listen even to the church, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. Truly I tell you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, truly I tell you, if two of you on earth agree about anything they ask for, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three gather in my name, there I am with them. There's loads to dig into in this. We need to note before we dive in, though, the big underlying idea behind everything that Jesus teaches about relationships and how you do your life. He's not interested in us getting projects done or having nice experiences or doing church activity. His driving goal in our lives is to change our character. That's what Jesus is after. Change our character, make us more like him. Everything else is supposed to help make that happen. And the first thing he says in this little paragraph, here we go, the Jesus guide. First thing, take the initiative, okay? If your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault. Just focus on that line. If your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault. Some of us are thinking, really, Jesus? Do I absolutely have to do that? That does not sound enjoyable. Look at how direct he is. Most of the experts on this passage I've read around it say this wasn't things that people were doing wrong generally. It was particularly meaning somebody who had offended you. They've upset you. And Jesus does not say, okay, if somebody offends you, just sit on it for a few weeks and you'll probably feel better. He doesn't say, wait for them to approach you because it's their fault anyway, isn't it? So they should approach you. He doesn't say, tell all the rest of your network of friends that they're terrible and just deal with it that way. He says, go and point out their fault. As I said, I'm sure some of us don't like that idea, but I'm sure others of us might be rubbing our hands together. Jesus says I need to go and tell people how they're wrong? Yes, amazing. I love doing that. That's one of my favourite hobbies. I can't believe he said that. Well, hold your horses. This is not supposed to be about diving in with your criticisms and enjoying feeling superior to them. We need to go about it in the way that Jesus says, as we'll come to. He says, go and point out their fault. So it's about being specific. You can't just approach somebody and be like, Piero, you're really annoying. You irritate me so much. Everything about you is excruciating. And Jesus wants me to tell you that. Like, you can't. That's just vague and offensive. It was fun to do it just then. But that's just vague and offensive. You can't do that. You can't also approach somebody about something that is not a fault, that's not a sin, but it just bothers you. You can't be like, Andy, mate, I've been spending a lot of time in prayer and I need to speak to you. God has nudged me because your hair is terrible. Look at it. I think God has better for you. You're welcome. Right? You can't do that. Again, that was fun. You can't do that. The point is to be specific about one thing and one thing that's significant. Loads of times in life, little offences happen and, you know, you've got to be gracious and let it go. But certain things need to be spoken about and addressed. And if the person keeps doing repeatedly or it's a huge thing that maybe only happened once. But if we're going to speak to somebody about what we think is a fault, we need to know what it actually is. What is it that they need to change for their own good? Not for your good, not to make you feel better, but for their good. How do you go about that? What Jesus says next is this. You go with humility and address them as an equal. He begins, if your brother or sister sins. And that sets the tone. And that posture is so important. You have to start there. If you see this other person, someone who has upset you, really, you know, angered you even, as a brother or sister, that means by definition you have to see them as an equal. They're not an enemy. You want what's best for them. You're not scoring points. You're not higher than them because they did something bad. You're approaching a person equal to you, which is fantastic because it should give both confidence and humility at the same time, which is a really helpful combination. If you ever think about approaching somebody else because of their faults, get this straight in your heart first, if you can. If you resent them and you can feel it bubbling, oh, I hate that person, they're so annoying, try and pray for them until you can honestly say you see them as a brother or sister. This is meant to be relational, not formal. It's not an HR meeting, it's a conversation. And this is the opening posture, so important, brother or sister. Then he says to approach them alone, just between the two of you. So you start by speaking to this person, they've offended you, you speak to them alone, informally. And Jesus has missed out, you may notice, what we often do when someone has offended us. We often first moan about them and gossip about them, and maybe we just sort of simmer with rage for a while. And Jesus doesn't mention any of those because those are not the things that we're supposed to do. Just think how many difficult relationships, tricky conversations would be improved if we just spoke the truth in love at the beginning, one-to-one. No bitterness, no gossip. But actually, it's really hard. Jesus is setting a very high bar when he says this. If someone hurts you, think about this, someone hurts you, you approach them, like he says, and they listen, and maybe they apologize, and there's a genuine change, the implication is you've got to move on. No need to involve other people, no need to complain or badmouth them. If you only involve more people, as we'll see, if they don't listen. The implication is, really, you've got to forgive them. That's the implication, you know, you move on. I've got to be honest, I can immediately think of a number of times in life when I've exactly, specifically not done what Jesus says here. I don't know about anybody else. Please, other people agree with me. Yes, Matt, we're nodding our heads. But the next thing he says, involve a few others if it's necessary. He says, if they will not listen, take one or two others along. Jesus is realistic to know sometimes people don't listen. Sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't. So maybe you approach somebody and they ignore you, they deny it, they get angry back at you. And this is the point where, let's be honest, most of us would probably just say, right, I'm going to leave them to it. I'm going to get on with my life. I'll just keep my distance from that person now because they're just hard work. That's not what Jesus says to do. Jesus is so committed to the character growth of people, he tells us to push through the awkwardness and says, no, if they don't respond, then you go to the next step, involving a few other people. Now, we've got to be careful. It doesn't mean just ganging up on somebody. It's just really sensible, this. If you involve more people at this stage, you have witnesses to the conversation, you have more voices of wisdom and reason, hopefully, and if there's been some sort of miscommunication, then having a few more people involved helps smooth that over. But it also makes it clear that whatever has gone on is serious. It's a slightly more formal approach, but still not public, not gossip, not attacking someone's reputation, any of that. And then last, Jesus says to involve the wider community if necessary. He says if they refuse to listen, tell it to the church. I think there's two reasons for this. Firstly, if you take it to the church, as in involve way more people, it really underlines how serious the issue is, assuming it's something big. So the person who has done wrong is now aware that a whole community takes this seriously. But secondly, it warns the church community about whoever this person is doing something destructive, not willing to change, because you don't want them going around damaging more people. This needs to be known about. And as a last resort, Jesus says, and this is really important, withdraw trust, but not love. I think he's saying withdraw trust, but not love. He says, if they refuse even to listen to the church, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. This is incredible because it's not actually as harsh as it sounds. This is not about insulting pagans and tax collectors. This is Jesus' way of saying, if someone doesn't listen and they won't change and you've done all these things, treat them like they're not part of the community. Now, we might hear that and think, well, hold on a minute, Jesus. We're the church. Aren't we supposed to include everybody and welcome everybody regardless of their behaviour? Well, yes and no. When Jesus meets pagans and tax collectors throughout the Gospels, how does he treat them? Not a trick question. How does he treat them? He treats them with love. So this is not about cutting off love, because it's always right to love people, whatever. But that's not the same as making them a trusted part of the community. Let me give an example of this. Imagine that Theo steals my wallet, right? I use him as an example because it's believable. And let's say I know for sure that he did it, right? I've got CCTV footage. I know that he did it, but he keeps denying it, right? Imagine this happening. It's quite extreme. Imagine it. Am I still called to love him in that situation? Yeah, of course I am. Yeah, you always love everybody. That's still always the right thing to do. No question. But do I still trust him? Is it still appropriate for him to be considered part of the community of the church, to be a Maybridge partner, to be trusted with things, to be in a leadership position, like he does leadership stuff, to count him as an example to other people? No, not until that's been resolved. So what Jesus, I think, is doing in this passage is not saying withdraw love, or not even withdrawing civility or friendliness, but withdrawing trust. It's withdrawing trust. If you read the Gospels, when Jesus actually encountered tax collectors and pagans, the exact thing that they needed, which he did, was to be loved, to hear the good news about him. That's what everybody needs when they are in some sort of fault or sin. Because the reason we do those things in the first place is that we haven't trusted the goodness of God and we've tried to make life work some other way. This passage itself was written by a tax collector, Matthew, who met Jesus and his life was changed. It's not that Jesus hated tax collectors, obviously. And so when he says about this person who keeps, you know, not changing, treat them like a pagan or a tax collector, he means treat them like somebody who doesn't yet have me in their life. Not treat them badly, but treat them wisely. Treat them as someone who has not yet encountered the fantastic news about me and been changed by it. That's what they need. Not to be alienated, but to be challenged by love. After this, Jesus says a few more things that actually they seem a bit unrelated, but they're not. They fit together. And this is a sort of comment on the, you know, he so understands human nature in this. Let's read this. Okay, I've pressed the wrong button. There we go. He says, truly I tell you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, truly I tell you that if two of you on earth agree about anything they ask for, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three gather in my name, there I am with them. All the binding and loosing stuff we're going to talk about next week. But for now, when Jesus says that line, wherever two or three are gathered, there I am with them. Who has been in a prayer meeting and heard somebody use that line? If you've been a Christian for more than 5 minutes, you've heard someone do that. And usually it's when the prayer meeting is not very well attended and the person leading it tries to drum up some enthusiasm and says, it's okay, two or three of us are gathered, God is with us. Am I right? Has that happened a million and one times? What it's really about, though, this passage, is when you approach someone to lovingly speak truth, you're probably feeling quite nervous about it, or, you know, maybe it doesn't go down very well, because that often happens. And it's easy to feel isolated and think, well, I did the things Jesus said in this passage. They didn't respond very well, didn't go down very well. Did I do the right thing? Should I have approached them? You know, was I being a bit over the top? This passage is God's affirmation. If you've got to the point of taking a few other sensible people and they're in agreement with you, you can have confidence you've gone about it in the right way and God is with you. Because approaching another person to point out their fault, like this says, there's big emotional stakes, aren't there? It's hard. It's hard to do that. And Jesus knows that, and he gives us this reassurance. That's what this is. When two or three are gathered, not in general, but to speak the truth in love to a brother or sister, there I am with them. I approve of this, I think, is what he's saying. So that's the Jesus guide to confrontation. It's amazing. It seeks resolution and restoration, top to bottom, amongst equal people. That's what he wants, good relationships. And yet he knows that human nature is such that it's very hard to get that. Eugene Peterson's translation of the Bible, The Message, puts this passage really nicely. And I could have read this rather than talked to you for the last 20 minutes, but I'll read it now. And he puts it like this. If a fellow believer hurts you, go and tell him. Work it out between the two of you. If he listens, you've made a friend. If he won't listen, take one or two others along so the presence of witnesses will keep things honest and try again. If he still won't listen, tell the church. If he won't listen to the church, you'll have to start over from scratch, confront him with the need for repentance, and offer again God's forgiving love. Doesn't that capture it really nicely? Just to sort of finish off, it's quite hard to argue with this model that Jesus gives. It's just so sensible, but it's hard to do. Just thinking about us as a church right now, you know, Jesus is the genius on how to live your life. But I've just got a few challenges maybe that would perhaps sit with us, and there's, well, four of them, and I want to see maybe if one or two of them just click with you and where you're at right now. And it's these. So firstly, if you're the sort of person that avoids confrontation at all costs, who's that? A few people. Ruth, you don't avoid confrontation at all costs. If you're one of those people who's not Ruth that avoids confrontation at all costs, will you choose to speak the truth in love, right? Most people don't like confrontation, especially English people. We don't want to upset anybody. We don't want to, you know, cause a fuss. Can I say something really controversial here, right? The choice not to approach somebody who has done something, you know, some sort of fault, to help them grow is selfish. The choice not to approach them is selfish. It's saying that protecting your own feelings of comfort and ease is more important than the character growth that God wants for them. How many people are there in our world that go through life making bad decisions, causing hurt, getting worse as the years go on, because nobody loved them enough to confront them when it needed to be done? How much could we serve others by choosing to follow the model that Jesus gives in this passage, not to make ourselves feel better, but for the benefit of the other person? For those that enjoy confrontation too much, anyone want to admit to that? Will you choose to see people as brothers and sisters? Some of us, and I'm sure it's a smaller group of people, love confrontation. We have no problem approaching somebody to speak our minds. However they react, we're going to tell them straight. If that's you, the challenge is to see them as a brother or sister, an equal, with gentleness, with humility, knowing you've got flaws too, and you might be wrong about what it is you're going to raise. Third, for those that are more likely to gossip or complain, will you choose to go alone first? It's very tempting to just complain about someone and dress it up as unburdening yourself. I just need to share my feelings somewhere. Sure, but will you, next time somebody offends you, just go to them first? Just try it. Go and speak to them with truth and humility. Just try out the Jesus model. And then fourth, for those that are more likely to ignore truth spoken in love, will you choose to listen? This is more a challenge for the person on the receiving end. If someone comes to you and assuming that, you know, they're trying to do it in the right way, will you listen to them? You don't have to agree with everything they say. They might have just got the wrong end of the stick or something. Okay. They might not communicate very well. But will you choose to see that God might be at work when someone comes and confronts you in love? It's very difficult. We all naturally want to defend ourselves. But the next time someone raises something with you, will you make it okay for them to do so? Having that posture might just be key to you growing as a follower of Jesus at that point in your life. I would bet everybody in this room could do with growing in at least one of these four things. We're a long way from getting all this right, this Jesus model. How reassuring. Jesus does not just say all great things like this. He lived it. It's amazing. You read through the Gospels, and page after page, he confronts people with love, confronts people with love, confronts people with love. And he doesn't always get a good reaction, let's be honest, but he never wavers from that approach. And he will choose to die for those same people. And it's exactly the same for us.